talking about the topic, and when I was at Brigham Young University preparing a little publication called The Open Door Guide to BYU, we wanted to include something about the comprehensive clinic. And so I went by. I was also personally interested, I think, on some level, and I took an IQ test and a Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory test, MMPI. And I can't remember the results of the IQ test, which is a bad sign, isn't it? But the MMPI was kind of interesting to me in that they told me that although I didn't have any personality disorders, I fell on the feminine side of the male-female spectrum. And then the graduate student who had conducted the test reached over and put his hand on my knee and said, "But that's okay, most BYU men fall on that side." So those of you who have heard before from David Knowlton, I'm sure have been as impressed as I have with his research and really his nerve in some of the topics he chooses, and really kind of a gutsy, no-nonsense approach to really some controversial issues. I think his attempts to infiltrate the terrorist groups in South America, at least on the level, I guess, of the intellectual support groups that feed the ones who are out in the jungle. I think that shows a high testosterone level, as well as some of the statements he's made otherwise in one session here on the Aymara Indian culture in Bolivia. When asked what his purpose was there, he had spent so much time, he said that it was to subvert the goals of the Mormon Church in trying to undermine their culture, which is really, you know, you can't get more blunt than that. His topic today is, of course, Mormon masculinity, a feminization of the national norm. And let me say something now also about Jim Duke so that he can respond directly after the paper. Is interested here, he in his bio that he provided me, he mentioned that he was a taxi driver in Boston, which which is probably a good qualification for a sociologist. David also, in response to that, mentioned that he sold jewelry one time. So they both have. Jim has a PhD from Harvard in sociology. He's on the sociology faculty at BYU and is, like David, one of the bright stars emerging from the younger generation of scholars, and has done quite a bit of evaluation for the LDS Church, as I guess the buzzword is you've been an evaluation researcher for the LDS Church. And this was an interesting little paragraph, and I don't want to take any more time, but he says, with the birth of daughter Emily, Jim, he says he embraced the joys of liberated fatherhood while his wife Kay worked and completed her degree at UMass Boston, a lifestyle that he, Kay, Emily, and Michael continue to enjoy and advocate. So both quite interesting individuals here. Without anything more, let's hear from Dave and then the response from Jim.
I have to ask for your forbearance today because I have virtually no voice. I arrived from South America Monday afternoon and promptly got a case of dysentery and lost my voice. It's great to be back in America. It's dangerous to make off-the-cuff comments because they often come back to haunt you, like wishing to subvert the church's goals and working with the Aymara. I think that deserves a little explanation. What I meant, as I remember, I don't remember the comment, was that I have a profound respect for the Aymara culture and its values, And oftentimes it does conflict with the goals of the church and its missionizing. I was recently in Bolivia. Can everybody hear me? I know I'm right at the edge. Okay. I was recently in Bolivia speaking with the church leadership in the PBO's office as well as the mission presidency. And it came out that there's a very strong conflict between the gospel, the church's organization, and its desire to preach to the Lamanites. The church, as it stands right now, has been an abysmal failure in the Indian areas of Bolivia. A branch that I reported to you before started as known as almost a miracle branch. And they built a beautiful chapel in the valley, but as it stands right now, on Sundays, virtually nobody but a small group of women come as a result because their priesthood isn't there, they can't have meetings. This kind of conflict is across the Altiplano. It's a conflict of culture. And it will not change until we learn to respect their culture and to find ways to teach the gospel into their culture. Anyway, a little editorial comment. I'd like to change right now and play with ideas, talk about American culture more than anything else, American and Mormon culture. As you know, around the country, groups of men have been gathering recently to explore their masculinity, to find ritual means of allowing the wild man within, so to speak, to be expressed, to bond with the more emergent sense of self, to find a way of overcoming the kinds of weakness and difficulties that they perceive in their own masculinity. In fact, the interest in these kinds of issues has led to a real growth industry of publications, speakers such as myself around the country addressing the concept of masculinity. I think that one of the authors, Guy de Cournot, a Canadian author, is right, that there is a crisis currently in the understanding of masculinity in much of the United States. Crises are marvelous because they show us as social analysts, social scientists, the deep structure within. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the crisis in American culture because I want to focus on Mormon culture. I just thought it'd be useful to locate my remarks in the context of national process. Let me also say that another beginning point of my talk has to do with feminist writing, a feminist discourse, and certainly the work of Mormon feminists. It has been said that the last remaining critical discourse, last remaining critical theory since the basic collapse of Marxist and thereby other socialist thoughts, is feminism. There's a tremendous body of work, and if nothing else, it has sensitized us to the issues of gender, to the way gender constructs our worldview, to the way gender is important in building our society, and to the importance, the critical importance, of the subtle minutiae of gender in terms of organizing inequality, power, and other social problems in society. However, as an anthropologist, I perceive a certain problem. There always has to be a but, right? Particularly if you're an intellectual. I perceive a certain problem. Feminist scholarship in anthropology, certainly, has developed itself in opposition to standard scholarship by defining standard scholarship as using the big word androcentric, which means male-centered. And there's often been the tacit assumption, that the standard social science description was an adequate understanding of maleness. I don't think so. I think that basing ourselves on the advances of feminist scholarship, we need to re-examine masculinity. We need to look at what it means to be a man. Not be a man in the sense of having hair on your chest, but what it means to be a biological male who is socialized into a given society, who learns to function in gender-specific ways, and who learns to interrelate with other people in terms of their gender. I think this is particularly important for those of us who are Latter-day Saints, because we come from a society that is very gender separated. Horrible sentence. We come from a society that separates us in terms of our gender. From the time we reach puberty, we learn that there are men and there are women. And an important part of celestial progress involves the coming together of the two genders. And I think we're also aware that there are a number of problems and issues surrounding that coming together that have been raised recently. In terms of anthropology, we really need to understand how societies construct gender, how concepts of masculinity are formed, what the forming means, how they relate to other concepts of gender, such as women. Let me say in passing that If we look at the societies around the globe, there are not two genders. There are many genders. Every society has a different way of mobilizing its resources, of taking the biological... Yes. Okay. Okay. Like this? It's still feeding back. Put it on the holder. Can you still hear me? Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. What I'm saying is that every society has a different way of mobilizing the biological fact of gender. We need to be clear that we're talking about distinct things. X and Y chromosomes are not the same thing as male and female. Okay? Particularly in many cultures around the world, we as Latter-day Saints tend to take the biblical, almost Victorian understanding that male and female created he, them, to be an understanding of biological science, that in the beginning there are two genders. Anything else is, or any wavering or misunderstanding or mismolding of that is a perversion. Other societies do not see this, do not take it this way. There are often multiple ways of creating gender, multiple ways of creating gendered human beings. I need to stress that because I want to talk a little bit more about masculinity and I want to delve into Mormonism, but to do that I need to make our way of creating gender, to make our way of looking at men and women be different, be seen as strange, rather than something that is inherently natural. I have to set it back so that we look at it freshly, rather than just assuming that there's an automatic equation between the Y chromosome and maleness. Okay? I'm coming from a basis of anthropological work that is really very thin and recent. David Gilmore recently published a book that I recommend to you called Cultural Concepts of Masculinity. A Manhood in the Making is the title. It's a very interesting look at manhood, the construction of masculinity across the globe. I think there are a couple of things that David Gilmore said that are very, very interesting. First of all, he points out that everywhere masculinity is an elaborated code. What that means is that masculinity is not something that is understood to come inherently from one's biology. That the fact that testosterone runs in one's veins is not enough to make one a man. In almost every society around the globe, manhood is a creation. It's a development. It's a taking of children, of moldable children, and inculcating them into a gendered identity, which is seen in opposition. Another point of David Gilmore is that manhood is seen as a reaction against womanness, which is often taken to be a more natural human code. Now, this is interesting because I just said that feminist argument has developed itself against androcentrism in discourse. Here we see a cultural argument that develops itself against woman-centrism or woman as the more basic human level. In our language, we may speak of men as being humans, as synonymous with human being. Yet in the discourse of masculinity, woman becomes a synonym with human being, and man then has to be developed out of this. I am sure that the feminists would argue that feminism is also an elaborated code. It is also a development against another kind of discourse. That's fine. It's not in at all disagreement with what Gilmore argues. The point is that manhood is created against something else, and that something else is often understood to be womanness. Let me give you an example. Last Saturday, I was on a plane flying from Santiago, Chile, to Arica, Chile, and during the middle, Latin Americans don't sit still. During the middle of the flight, people were wandering around, talking to another, reforming groups, starting to play cards, drinking a little bit in different parts of the plane. One young child, a young boy about 2.5 years old, suddenly started crying, not infrequent when young children are on flights. His father was taking care of him, and he tried to calm the child and quiet him and nurture him. Finally, he got frustrated, and he took the child and held him like this, and he said, "No seas mujer." He said, "Don't be a woman." In other words, don't cry. The message is clear. In this interaction, the father was teaching the boy that to be a man, he had to not be a woman. That womanness was the more basic level. Manhood had to be a reaction against it. I don't think this is strange to any of us who've grown up in Western American culture, where you learn very quickly what is appropriate male stance, appropriate male interaction, where we become paranoid about the slightest drop of a wrist. Where we become paranoid about the way we cross our legs. Where we become paranoid about the way we walk, the way we talk, a little extra sibilance. The interesting thing is that this is not womanness in an empirical sense. It's a male discourse and a male attempt to recreate womanness as something to react against. Okay? Another important point about masculinity, according to Gilmore, is that masculinity is a public statement. It requires public validation. It requires performance. Performance. Let me state it again. Performance. In other words, you are only as much a man as your last male act. Now, this makes manhood a very insecure status. No matter how manly you may be, according to Gilmore around the globe, you very easily can lose your maleness, this desired status of respect, and retreat back to the position of the womanly man, the effeminate male. And I stress this because everywhere, although the particulars of how maleness is developed or mobilized or understood may vary, this oppositional nature, the requirement of performance, of public display of maleness, seems to be almost universal, according to Gilmore's study. Now, that's a fascinating point in and of itself. Let me see. There's a couple other points I want to make out of Gilmore, and then I want to move on. One other point of Gilmore is that many societies have mediating categories between men and women. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, although it's absolutely fascinating. Our own American Indians, many tribes have had what is known as the burdash. The burdash is a womanly man or a manly woman, depending on the case. The important thing about this mediating category is that they're often seen as the shamans, the healers, the people who have spiritual power, precisely because they don't stand at either one of the poles. They're betwixt and between. As a result, they're granted tremendous spiritual power and importance. This is not unusual. Shamans in much of Amazonia are often people of who are seen to be mixed gender. They're neither man nor woman. They're both. Because in their person, they're able to bridge the domains. They're seen to have magical spiritual importance. Okay, one could take and look into Christianity, look at the priest, the Catholic priest, as someone who's supposed to be celibate, as a sexless male. Also someone who is mediating between the categories in one way or another. The structural argument can get very dense and almost at times seemingly trivial. But I want to point out that there's a consistent relationship between these median genders and ritual, religion, and some sort of spiritual calling or healing calling. Another point of manhood universally is that there is a constant fear of regression, meaning a regression back into the womanly state. Rituals that are established in society, institutional forms, tend to take the stance of maintaining masculinity, of making it an unchangeable aspect. Another point of this, the flip side, is that whenever men seem to deviate from what is understood to be the optimum, the normal, the normative, then they're accused of having regressed. Okay? They're accused of retreating more to the basic level. You all can fill in the blanks with all the insults that are used on playgrounds and more sophisticated ways of saying the same thing in business conference halls. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about Mormon masculinity. We Mormons do not have the privilege of creating our society in a vacuum. And I stress that we are a society. We're not simply a church. We're not simply a group of people who share a common desire to worship Christ and to be like Christ. We are also a functioning society with a culture. We don't have the liberty of creating that in a vacuum. What this means is that we are always in interaction, in opposition, in disagreement, or in agreement with the larger society, with national society. Masculinity is a case in point. All of us are socialized into the American norms of masculinity in one way or another. However, the church as an institution and as a society attempts to create a different way of understanding men. It attempts to create out of the discourse the understandings of maleness, everything from John Wayne to George Bush to Ezra Taft Benson and in between. It attempts to take from those, separate some out, include some, and give them positive strength. However, to give them, to guarantee them positive strength, it needs to grant them a priority in our lives that's very difficult to maintain. It has to stamp them with authority, stamp them in a way that makes them primary to our life. In my remarks today, I primarily want to focus on this structural conflict between a more basic American understanding of masculinity and the more exclusive Mormon way of attempting to create and understand what it means to be male. And then towards the end, after I've deployed this, I want to talk about some of the possible consequences of this problem or this issue and what it means for the actual structuring and formation of the church, what it means for our social reactions. And then I'd like to, after Jim gets to comment, I'd like to encourage you all to give feedback and thought on the issue. Okay, let me develop this. The fact that Mormons then have to develop an alternative maleness, a cultural system that is in tension, opposition, and conflict, means a number of things. Let's look at Mormon values of maleness. Mormons value a man who, in one part, is spiritual. They value a man who is a church leader. They value a man who at least should be involved in his home, who should be involved in nurturing, caring. They do not value a man who is sexually active outside of marriage. They do not value a man who is involved in barroom scraping. They do not value extreme aggressiveness, scrapping. Remember, contention is a sign of the adversary. Yet all of these things that are not valued are important parts of American male discourse. If we think just in terms of popular culture, we understand that manhood is expressed in our society in terms of sexual activity. That one's sexual activity becomes an index of one's maleness. Yet our culture has the problem, the difficulty of teaching young men and then maintaining in older men controlled sexuality. Sexuality is focused primarily on building and maintaining families. A conflict right in the middle of a very powerful biological drive that also is seen as defining in both Mormon discourse as in non-Mormon discourse of our masculinity. In Mormon discourse, because we're fathers of families, or some of us are, I'm still single, but fathers of families, our eternal increase is our posterity, is part of our definition, and to push it even further, our creation, part of our elevation into godhood at some future state. All prohibited to us. Aggressive fighting, in many ways, is prohibited. Certainly within a church domain. Spirituality, religious involvement, active involvement in religion, active involvement in the kind of involvement we expect of Mormons, is often portrayed stereotypically as being a woman's domain. If you look at Latin American Catholicism, and I'm aware that this, I've suddenly made a move away from the United States, but if you look at Latin American Catholicism, you find men and women who claim to be Catholics. The men may go to church four times in their life. The women are expected to go to church constantly. The men claim to be as religious in many ways, or as involved as the women. But yet, being in the church, being involved in the church, is not part of their definition of maleness. We have the difficulty of incorporating men into a religious community, where the religious community becomes the focus, and stamping men with values that are alternative, that are some ways contrary to American norms. Now, the difficulty in this, as I said, we are both Americans and Mormons. We're Americans and Latter-day Saints. As a result, there's always a tension at a structural level between our society and the outer society, but also psychodynamic tension within us between the different discourses of masculinity. For sake of argument, I'm taking and making it a pair. Really, it's much more complex, but I'm afraid that we would spend hours in the complexities, and so allow me this simplicity, if you will. We, in other words, on a psychodynamic level, we also participate in both discourses that may or may not lead to tension, but the tension is always possible. Let me just see if there was anything that I left out. As a result, I don't think that it is surprising that, according to Ron, on the MMPI, the Mormon men would be seen as being somewhat effeminate. Let me tell an anecdote. I grew up in West Texas and moved to Utah when I was a teenager. And I'll tell you, from the point of West Texas, Utah men are very effeminate. In their stance, their way of walking, in their very non-aggressive, non-competitiveness. Let me also mention that there's a value placed on cooperation in Utah maleness, a value placed on solidarity that is not absolute, but in contrast with the scrapping individuality of the Anglo-Texan male, or the John Wayne almost isolation that's an exaggeration. The Utah male is much more collegial. Utah, I think we could spread this probably to Mormon, but I don't know. It's an anecdote. Much more collegial, much more group-oriented, much less caustic in their interactions with other people, competitive, by and large, in their interactions with other people. Okay, let me try to develop this structural dichotomy. If indeed I am right, if this is an accurate portrayal, and you're welcome to argue with me, then we can see a number of consequences that probably follow from it. First of all, since Mormon society is a society that attempts to maintain itself and reproduce itself, and yet from the point of view of the national vantage point, it would seem to be more a domain of womanly values, there's a need if that is to be the place where men are to develop their masculinity according to this discourse. And mind you, I'm not arguing for it. I'm trying to discuss it and analyze it. If this is the place where men are seen to be developing their discourse, then indeed this area must be masculinized in order to maintain and prop up the discourse. I would think that this would lead to an inherent tension within Mormonism between the position of women in the church and the position of men in the church. In that, women, as they develop more leadership potential, or as they used to have more leadership potential, women as they experience more spiritual commitment, inherently tend to challenge the position of men within the community. Because of this opposition built within the discourse, Mormon discourse of masculinity, as opposed to the discourse of national masculinity. I think that another example of issue here has to do with the relative lack of development of Mother in Heaven within our gospel theology. If I am right, it would be very difficult to have a concept of Mother in Heaven, a firmly valued concept of Mother in Heaven anchored in male discourse. Instead, we try to develop a theology that focuses more on a masculine father, a father that, following Durkheim, is a projection of our society, of our own desires, onto the heavens. Forgive the sociology. We can talk about the sociology worldview as opposed to the religious worldview later. But I would think we tend to see a projection. Because of the conflict between Mormon discourse of men and the national norm, I would argue it becomes very difficult to really solidly develop a theology of Mother in Heaven without inherently reconfiguring, changing, and transforming what it means to be a man as it's built into Mormon discourse and as young men are socialized into the church. Another issue here then has to do with the inherent tensions between men and women. Women are become not just the baseline out of which masculinity is defined. They also become the proving ground, but the challenge, the threat to masculinity. I would expect to find in Mormon culture what has been called elsewhere strong castration anxiety, or lots of mythology relating to themes that in the mythological literature has been called the vagina dentata. What it means simply, forgive the words, but what it means simply is the fear of women as the people who demasculinize men. Okay? I would expect there to be tremendous anxiety involved in almost every interaction. I'm told that at BYU, where I now work, it's not uncommon for married men when they find themselves suddenly out in a rainstorm with no umbrella and a woman drives by, they're almost expected to turn down the ride that might be offered, lest there be an appearance of evil. Well, that's an interesting piece of folklore. Whether it's true or not, it points out the anxiety inherent in male-female interactions. In strange male-female interactions, yes. But I would expect that anxiety also to be manifested in male-female interactions within the home, within couples, within families. Because women become very dangerous. I know I'm speaking simplistically, but women become very dangerous towards the male identity, towards male mobilization of self. Some other examples, perhaps, of some of the tensions. Since I've been back in Utah, I've been absolutely flabbergasted, surprised at the number of people who've come and talked to me about sexual dysfunction in their marriage. Why me? I think I must look like a priest. I don't know. I swear sometimes my office tends to take the character of a confessional rather than an academic office. But I've been really surprised. As an anthropologist, I know that in these folk tales, there's a cultural logic. Empirically, the data can be challenged. As to whether it's representative can be challenged as well. But let me look at it as cultural logic. A number of men have come in and told me that, they married very quickly off their mission. No surprise, right? It was very difficult to begin sexual functioning in marriage. It's very difficult, as we all know, to move from no-no to yes-yes. Yet, sexuality was so important to their definition of maleness that there is almost a need to function as sexually potent within the marriage in a situation creating tremendous anxiety for a number of reasons. One, morally, sexuality is the sudden death aspect of Mormonism, in the sense that it's the one guaranteed thing that if you do wrongly, you can lose your membership in the body. That in and of itself creates tremendous anxiety. But also, because of the ongoing anxiety vis-a-vis women, ultimately what surprised me in the relationships is that by and large, the men had ceased to be the initiators of sexuality. Instead, they became the ones who had functioned sexually on demand, meaning when their wives demanded. And oftentimes, there would seem to be difficulties of maintaining an erection or actually reaching orgasm. Now, as you can see, I'm surprised at the openness with which people talk to me. Nonetheless, I will report it. Hey, we anthropologists are great gossips. If you... Another interesting factor is that, as I've overheard a number of conversations at BYU among women, it seems that there are sort of a number of stereotypes of men. There's the concept of the frigid Mormon male. Anybody heard that? Sounds very familiar to what I just described, what my friends told me. There's the cultural construct of the male who'll never touch a woman. Meaning the young women go out on dates with a man, and the man constantly seems distant, not engaged, unwilling to touch them and hold their hand, unwilling to engage in things that were sort of culturally not supposed to talk too much about, but, you know, the sort of pre-sexual interpersonal involvement. Well, it's hard to say. Yeah, what is that? Hey, how would I know? I'm a Mormon male. No. It's involvement in necking, involvement, but even more than that, it's involvement in actual touching. In my introduction anthropology classes, I have the students write an ethnography, and I leave the topic open. An awful lot of the students have written ethnographies about dating, and many of them in passing have focused on the code of touching. What does touching mean? Is it okay to hold hands on the first date? Hey, I'm serious. That was actually written in a paper. Is it okay to kiss on a first date? At Washington University, where I taught, the question is it okay to have intercourse on a first date? But what I'm saying is there's tremendous focus and cultural tension on every aspect of male-female involvement, male-female engagement. Underlying that, I'm arguing, there's a cultural tension built in that makes it very difficult for men, because behind it is their definition of self, but also attention vis-a-vis the national culture. Okay, see how I'm doing for time. I think that we can go on and develop other aspects of this tension, the problems within our society involving male-female interactions. I think that many of those ultimately can be argued to stem, or at least be related to, the sort of cultural tension that's built into the process. In other words, what I'm saying is that in Mormonism there's a double bind, a multiple double bind. First of all, there's the double bind of our involvement in our gospel and its creation of maleness, and in our involvement with the broader national culture. Furthermore, there's a double bind of being men within the church as sexual and non-sexual beings. I would like now to move from that, and let me see where I lost my place in my notes. I don't think this is surprising. If we look at similar cases, if we look at Victorian England, for example, which is another culture with a rather similar discourse of malehood, manliness, we see tremendously interesting writings about maleness. We see the definition of maleness almost focusing entirely on people such as Richard Burton, the famous explorer, who was also inherently a rebel from British society. We see in Victorian England tremendous focus on male-female interactions, the fear of male-female interactions, as developed in the work of D.H. Lawrence. I don't know how many of you all have recently read Women in Love or seen the movie, but in Women in Love, women are associated almost entirely with death. Every time a male engages in a relationship with a woman, the male dies. In a meaningful, full relationship, the male dies. Lawrence writes endlessly about the need for male bonding, the need for male involvement with other men. And yet it's the one thing that can never be fulfilled, because on the horizon of that argument is always the argument of homosexuality, is always the problem of homosexuality. I don't think that's that different from our Mormon culture, because also within Mormon culture, in terms of the gender separation, we have an encouragement of men to develop male bonding. We have an encouragement of quorum leaders, such as bishoprics, or quorum presidencies, to develop a companionship, a spirit of love and solidarity. Men and encourage them on missions to develop strong love for their companion. We encourage quorums, in ways that seldom happen in my experience, to develop a strong spirit of solidarity, of love, of male bonding. Yet underneath each of those aspects of bonding is a real problem, a real issue, namely that of homophobia, that of moving beyond the masculine, moving into the problematic aspects of maleness. The bonding that occurs is a limited bonding. It's a bonding that is able to express certain aspects of maleness, certain aspects of intimacy, certain aspects of involvement, but that maintains outside the pale much of interpersonal belonging, interpersonal involvement, and interpersonal engagement, it seems to me. And I would argue that part of the reason for that is precisely this conflict between the masculine and feminine within national culture and Mormon culture. Let me give an analogy. If we look in football, in sports, we see in our society that men are much more able to touch one another. They're able to give each other pats on the butt, so to speak. They're able to engage in locker room play. I was recently speaking to somebody who was in the military and told me that in the military it's not uncommon for men to go around and play the game, the schoolroom game of in the showers, to play the schoolyard game of goosing one another. I don't know. I've never been in the military. But it would make sense, because both sports, athletics, and the military are domains in which masculinity is value, the sort of the masculine domains par excellence, where there can be no question of non-masculine behavior. However, in a place like the church, where the domain itself is seen to be, from the standpoint of the national culture, as a more feminine domain, masculine involvement becomes a problem. It becomes an issue always just latent under the surface. And men within the church have to be very careful to mobilize themselves in ways that set off and portray their masculinity. In talking with Jim yesterday, I think one aspect of this, one consequence of this, is that we see in leadership a tremendous emphasis on authority as the definition of maleness, rather than on, let's say, service or nurturing or caring. Instead of the bishop as mother, we see the bishop as father, with the sort of stereotypical roles attached to them. As father, he becomes the one who commands, the one who leads, the one who punishes, supposedly. Instead of the one who nurtures, the one who listens, the one who is sympathetic. Out of the possibilities, we choose to focus on authority rather than on nurturing. And I think that has to do precisely with this sort of structural bind. I think another aspect of this problem or this issue in terms of maleness within the church is that in terms of church sports, we see a tremendous emphasis on church sports, particularly in younger men. However, the folklore is that in church sports, Mormon men are the least sportsmanlike. that in terms of sports, you usually get very aggressive, very wild behavior, very undoctrinal behavior, not uncommon to hear the F word, so to speak, and so on. I don't think this is an accident, because if I'm right that there's tremendous pressure on Mormon men because of this structural paradox, then one would expect that in the domain of sports, in the domain that is seen as nationally as a domain where men prove themselves and express themselves, we'd see sort of a compensatory activism, in other words, an acting out, an over-portraying of maleness. I think some other problems that we have with the community also involve sexuality. I was in a panel earlier where they were talking about child abuse. I've been told that Utah has awfully high rates of male child abuse by adult married men. I do not know if that's true. Whether it's true or not, the gossip, again, is interesting. I've also been told that among Mormons there is a higher number of homosexuals than one would expect, given national statistics. Again, I do not know if that's true, but the gossip is telling. I've also been told that sexual dysfunction is not just something that happens to my friends, but is rather common in our society. And I would also expect that to be true if I am right about the tension inherent between the two genders. Let me speak for a little bit off the cuff about women in the church. Am I out of time? Okay, I'm just going to make a quick statement. I think that in the development of feminist discourse within the church, the discourse of masculinity and the tensions and insecurities of Mormon men need to be taken into account in terms of the development of new alternative means or the development of new arguments. And I hope that what I said today, unstructured though it may have been, is an attempt, a valid attempt and a useful attempt to try to conceptualize some of the issues. Thank you.
When my wife and I made the decision several years ago to have our first child, we agreed that at least for the first year, I would take care of the baby while she was working and attending the university. And that decision grew out of her commitment and mine to both feminism and to children. And as the years have gone on, I think we've worked hard and been reasonably successful at sharing these roles of providing and caring for the kids. Sometimes we even do housework. For me, many life experiences come to be crystallized in particular moments that I remember. And one moment that captures a particularly important part of my experience of being what I call a feminist father occurred when our daughter Emily was about 2 months old. And I don't remember the context. What I remember is walking up the street from the apartment where we lived in Somerville, Massachusetts, with our daughter in one of these snuggly infant carriers. We lived in a pretty solidly working class, first generation Italian immigrant neighborhood, where most of the people living there were older. Their children had gone, and so it was senior citizens primarily. And as I walked up the street, I suddenly had the sensation that the conversation had turned to me, that people were looking at me and they were discussing what I was doing. But the real memory is that in the moment I became aware, self-conscious about being observed, I had an emotional response that intellectually I picked up almost instantly. And that was that I was ashamed. I was ashamed to be seen in the middle of the day when I ought to be off working, carrying my infant daughter on my chest. Now, intellectually, I knew that what I was doing was something to be very proud of. But my intellectual commitment didn't magically free me from my own socialization, from the expectations that were imposed on me by the culture that I lived in. And experiences like that one convinced me that Dave is correct in suggesting that whether or not we're experiencing a crisis of masculinity, there is in any case considerable uncertainty, considerable anxiety that's being brought to the surface as a result of the changes that are occurring in the lives of men and women, many of them brought on by the women's movement. So I think that the foundations of masculinity, the bases of masculinity, is an important topic, one worth thinking about, particularly by those who are interested and concerned about choosing new directions for men and for women. In thinking through some of the ideas that Dave raised, I was initially struck, as I think he was, by the particularities of Mormonism and the ways in which Mormonism may be distinctive. The more I thought about it, the more I began to feel that many of those elements are, in fact, commonalities after all, that they aren't so different from the dominant culture. Just as one example, many ethnographers in Northern America have documented what has come to be called a cycle of hard living and settled living among lower class and working class males, in which the man essentially establishes the settled living pattern where he brings home the bacon, so to speak. He provides for his family. The only problem is that that the way he does that is by giving appropriate deference at work, and that lack of control, that inability to control his own life, at some point just becomes so galling that he does the masculine thing and tells the boss to shove it. And for an hour or two, he is a real man again. The problem then, of course, is that having said what he said to the boss has consequences. He's no longer able to fill the role of the provider, and so the man enters the hard living stage of the cycle, drinking and carousing and doing what teenage working class and lower class males do, until at some point, hopefully, he comes out on the other end of the cycle and jumps back into the settled living pattern again. The same sort of anxiety about masculinity, the same expectations, in a sense, several of the important props for a man's masculinity are taboo, are taken out, and that makes the props that remain vulnerable, uncertain, and highly emphasized. On the other hand, noting those kinds of commonalities between what I see as the Mormon culture and the mainstream American culture, I think really serves to highlight certain very distinctive features of Mormonism, that in the absence of very many other substantial supports for buttressing a masculine identity, Mormon men, I think, very often do latch on to patriarchal authority as a key component of the masculine identity. And what this means, I think, is that that any issue that connects with women and authority, whether it's the priesthood question, questions about a mother in heaven theology, even something as basic as support for the traditional family pattern, those all become necessarily more than simply a dominant group protecting its privileges and prerogatives from a subordinate group. Those all become very quickly all about men confronting a fundamental challenge to their masculinity. That introduces a whole new dynamic into all of those kinds of issues and questions. Let me just raise two very broad questions, and these are really in the spirit of the thought paper in the sense that they're thought questions. They're not questions that Dave will necessarily respond to. The first that I find is really the practical question of how do we construct a positive, productive definition of Mormon masculinity, one that is not threatened automatically by the occupational success or the religious authority of women. More concretely, I found it was very easy for me to explain to my daughter Emily the difference between boys and girls. Girls can have babies and boys can't. Got it. Piece of cake. Tell me, what do I tell my son? Girls can have babies and boys can't. That's the best I can do, but that establishes essentially a negative identity. He knows what he isn't. But concretely, what are the positive elements of a Mormon masculinity that don't in some way involve an exclusion of women or an assertion of domination? The second question that moves, I think, in a completely opposite direction, and that is, going back to Gilmore's work, is this need for a proof of masculinity really a human universal, or is it simply ubiquitous, common, but not culturally necessary? All my experience with adults suggests that gender differentiation is enormously laden, both psychologically and culturally. But my experience with children suggests just the opposite, that children are remarkably capable of dealing with gender differences with the same pragmatic, honest, candid approach that they use in the rest of life. And I'm going to give you two of my own little stories and then try to give the rest of you some time for comments. Both of our children had birthdays in the last couple of weeks. Their birthdays come together. We gave them each a doll. One of them, an Asian doll named Hiroshi, the other, a Latin American doll named Maria. And both children play with both dolls, and they have a good time with them. The problem that we hadn't anticipated is that, as it turns out, the dolls are quite difficult to tell apart. They both have darker skin and dark hair. If you put the two dolls next to each other, it's obvious which doll is which. You can tell from the eyes and the tone of the skin color and everything. But if they're sort of by themselves, you're never sure which doll you've got. Now, as it turns out, it's an easy problem to solve because these dolls happen to be anatomically correct. So all you've got to do is to check in the diaper and you know whether this is Hiroshi or Maria. And we didn't have to explain that to our 4-year-old daughter. She picked it up right away, so she knows how to tell the dolls apart. If she doesn't have them next to each other, she just very routinely takes a little look. All right, this is Hiroshi, and she goes on. And I have yet to detect any anxiety, any particular curiosity on her part. Simply, the babies are different, and this is how you tell which one is which. And the gender differentiation there is straightforward, it's honest, and relatively free from anxiety. The second is a funny story I read, and I wish I could find the source, but I'll give it to you the best I can remember, written by a mother who, in the story, is giving her two children a bath. And the older daughter, perhaps 3 years old, notices that her younger brother has this curious anatomical peculiarity there between his legs and asks the mother about it. And the mother, who's very anxious to diffuse any possibility of penis envy in her daughter, explains about boys and girls as candidly and as openly as she can possibly manage. And her 3-year-old daughter listens very carefully and then thinks about it a minute and replies, "It's a good thing it didn't grow on his face." Now, I hope the story hasn't offended anyone. I seriously considered skipping the story just in case, but of course, those kinds of considerations, thinking about whether to leave the story out, point exactly to the kinds of concerns that that are central here. As adults, we're very anxious about something which children apparently approach in a very healthy and open way. And those kinds of experiences with children make me very skeptical about Freudian or raw psychodynamic or sociobiological explanations of gender differentiation. I find myself looking much more strongly at cultural kinds of explanations. And that, for me, then, I think raises the question of whether the crisis of masculinity is, in fact, a crisis or whether it's simply a cultural opening, an opportunity. Is it possible for a modern society to function without socially defined constructions of masculinity and femininity? Or are we necessarily going to have to approach the whole issue on the ground of the first question of constructing a positive, viable definition of Mormon masculinity. All right, enough said.
Officially, our time is up, but I think unofficially we could take a couple of questions. Okay?
The question is very difficult to repeat for the sake of the tape, but let me repeat it, try to see if I understand anyway. No, that's fine. It's a lovely question. It's easier to respond to than to repeat, unfortunately. The question was whether we were talking about deep structure, and you said the Mormon man was stretched between the avunculate position, and we'd have to talk more about what you mean by avunculate, and the castrating father.
Avunculate is like the father body.
Okay. Yeah. In other words, you're speaking about the avunculate in our society. I've got it. Okay. As opposed to, well, anyway, the point was that there was a stretching their attention. Would we see then as a result hysteria? It's the kind of tremendous anxiety-producing mechanism. I don't know if I can respond to whether we see hysteria. That's kind of an empirical question. I haven't done the empirical work. It would be interesting to look at the presence of hysteria in Mormon men as opposed to other men. I think, though, you're pointing at something, whether we may argue with the polls, but I think you're right that there is a stretching of Mormon men. It's not just the kind of thing that produces difficulties. It's almost the classical model for producing schizophrenia, when you're caught between two very different models of what it means to be a man and trying to work and in an attempt to try to work them out as you go on. I suspect that most Mormon men don't maintain simultaneously both models. I suspect that they're more located in different times and spaces, and we tend to move back and forth between them. But nonetheless, the tension is there. I'd like to play just a minute with the notion of mediating, also in response to Jim. I have to say I agree with Jim's critiques and criticisms. I'm afraid, terribly boring to agree with people too much, but I agree with what Jim said. However, I think that what we need to do is look more at the notion of mediation, look more at the notion of alternative formations of maleness, because they are present in our society. The problem is not the lack of alternative notions of maleness. The problem is the lack of validation of alternative notions of maleness. I think in the movement that Robert Bly is leading, one sees an attempt to recreate a positive male image among people who, for one reason or another, seem to lack that validation culturally. I'm not speaking psychologically. I'm speaking the lack of cultural positive support for being the sensitive male as opposed to being the wild man. There's a need to take the wild man, remove it from the imagery of cowboy movies, and recreate it in terms of one's own self-expression. It's taking, as Christ took the commandments, the gospel, took and removed them from external forces, external actions, and made them part of individual belief and individual interaction with God. I think we see a similar kind of recreation of the discourse of masculinity in terms of the men's movement today. But the themes you raise are very important ones. I can't answer them, unfortunately, totally well.
Yeah. Yes. You suggested that the Mormon men have some castration anxiety. Mm-hmm. I can't even get it out. Castration anxiety. You know, I have this idea that
Well, we can argue as to whether we... Oh, yeah. You're stating... Let me see if I can synthesize the question. You're stating that although we have de jure patriarchy, that in fact we have matriarchy, and that in terms of castration anxiety, it may have more to do with this position of women's power and of the kind of activities that women engage in as part of the matriarchy are seen as being very threatening to men. Is that a fair restatement?
And it's an effort by women to compensate for the de jure deprivation of
okay.
power.
It's an effort by women to compensate for the de jure deprivation of power. I think we can argue about whether we have matriarchy or patriarchy in Mormonism. I do think that actually women are removed from many positions of the church precisely because of the ambivalence in maleness. And I think that it'd be interesting to look at this historically to see whether there's historical evidence in the time of change when women started losing positions and power and prestige in the church, and we started moving to this very tight, dense, male-dominated church that we have today, as to whether there was also a change in the position of men vis-a-vis the larger society. I would not be surprised if there was. I know that at a time of crisis like today, the discourse of manhood is under tremendous pressure. Also, at a time when Mormon men are occupying this domain, when they're struggling against cultural discourses of sexuality, discourses of maleness, of acting out. We all consume popular movies, popular culture, whether we go to R-rated movies or not. We all are aware of the popular discourses. And as a result, I would argue that that would tend to put more pressure and tension on men, making a basis for the removal of women from the domains of power. I think you also see, though, that anxiety in everyday interaction with men and women. Now, as to the details of what might cause in any one case, castration anxiety, and I don't like those terms, but whatever might cause the anxiety in the relationship, I think that anxiety is there. And I think we ought to speak openly about the anxiety in the relationships between the genders, because we live in a very gender-dual society as Mormons, where we strongly separate. As I said at the beginning, not every society does that. To disagree with Jim, the penis is not the primary marker of maleness in our society or any other. There are plenty of men who have penises who are not men. We need to learn to look with different eyes.